Hello, and welcome to Ask Dr. Dawn. The opinions expressed in this program are those of the speakers, and this is a program intended for education and entertainment. It should not be construed as a substitute for a medical consultation. Well, today on Ask Dr. Dawn, we'll be honoring an unsung pioneer in research on agriculture who saved millions of lives. He was also a true survivor in his own life. We'll be thinking a little bit about how human systems and groupthink can damage society, and also the systems dynamics of research. We'll be talking about functional medicine and acupuncture topics, and covering some good and some bad news from the recent COVID research. And of course, also answers to your emails. Let's talk about Yuan Longping, born 1930, died 2021. Yuan was a key player in the Green Revolution of the mid-20th century. He also became one of China's most famous scientists. He died on May 22, 2021. He was honored in his country at the end when the Olympics came to China in 2008. He carried the torch. His life reflected the fortuitous conjunction of the four factors that he thought were important against the backdrop of a turbulent century. When asked about the secret to his success, he listed knowledge, hard work, intuition, and opportunity. Well, he had also lots of adversity. Let's learn a little bit about Yuan. He was born September 7th, 2030 in Beijing, on the eve of the Communist Party's China victory in 1949. He was born, there was an emperor. By the time he went to college, there was a Communist Party running the country. And during the 1950s, China looked to the Soviet Union for guidance in science and technology. Unfortunately, in the Soviet Union, science was very political, and a great favorite, I should say, of the Politburo in the Soviet Union was an agronomist named Trofim Lysenko. Well, many of Lysenko's ideas were wrong. He didn't believe in evolutionary biology, for example, and he had all sorts of other ideas that, well, they didn't pan out, but they were the politically correct ideas. In fact, one of Yuan's teachers at the university was branded an enemy of the Communist Party in 1957 and actually committed suicide in the early 1960s during the early years of the Cultural Revolution. Just parenthetically, I'll say that the Cultural Revolution, if you don't know what it was, if you don't understand what happened in China in the mid-20th century, both the Cultural Revolution and the Great Leap Forward, I highly recommend you go to Wikipedia and read that history, or pick up a book even if you're interested. There's a wonderful book called The Extraordinary Hallucinations and the Madness of Crowds, or something like that. And it goes through all of these sort of history of groupthink and the sort of devastating things that come out of it. A more recent contemporary example is what happened in China in between the late 50s and the mid 70s. And it's an astonishing story. Well, back to Yuan. When he graduated in 1953, he went to teach agronomy. So he was a college professor, a tiny little school. Well, maybe he's lucky it was tiny, because during the Great Leap Forward, he lived in the countryside. This great leap forward resulted in a terrible famine. Tens of millions of Chinese died, many of them trying to live on tree bark and grass unsuccessfully. On his way to work, Yuan would pass the bodies of those who had starved to death in the road. He never forgot those things. And so from 1960 on, he focused on China's most important staple crop, rice. In the West, meanwhile, there was a thing going on called the Green Revolution. Hybridization of wheat and corn had led to hybrid plants that were much more vigorous and much more productive. This, however, was not so easy to do with rice, because rice was a self-pollinating crop. Hard to hybridize something like that. Yuan went hunting for hybrid rice. Now, what's that mean? Well, it basically means you've got horses and donkeys, and when you crossbreed them, you get a mule. And a mule's stronger than a donkey and doesn't need as much food as a horse, but it can't reproduce. If you find rice that can't reproduce, then you can study it. I don't understand the process that they used, but it was extremely important to find this piece. Now, things did okay. That calmed down a little bit after the Great Leap Forward. And then in 1966, another crash. This time, anyone with any kind of intellectual background was denounced as a counter-revolutionary. They were getting ready to put him in the prison that they reserved for intellectuals. However, a letter came from the National Service saying, you know, we really like this guy's research. We think he can help feed the people, so he's not a counter-revolutionary after all. Ron was, he basically dodged that bullet and was allowed to keep working. He spent enormous, enormous amounts of his time hunting for the wild strains necessary to try to create improved cereal crops. And finally, in the 1970s, they succeeded. Rice yields in the mid-1980s climbed enormously, rather like the stock market can during a bubble. By 1999, it was estimated that the production increases brought about by the hybrid rice that Yuan and his co-workers invented fed an additional 100 million Chinese people a year. Let me just talk a little bit about one thing. As a late boomer, I can tell you that there was kind of a trope or a meme in my childhood. When you weren't eating your supper, your parent would remind you that there were children starving in China. Children starving in China isn't something that is particularly common, even in the poor rural villages anymore. China's made enormous progress, and I'm not seeking to belittle the country and the progress it's made. A great deal of human suffering has been averted. But I do want to comment on prejudice a little bit, because when I started, and I have a little bit of my own unconscious bias, I must say, because when I was handed this article, the first thing I thought was, oh, GMO. And I had to step back and examine, think a little bit about golden rice, which was a genetically modified organism that came out in the 90s. And rice is a very, very good thing to eat, but it lacks certain nutrients. In particular, what they wanted to do was prevent blindness in poor countries. And blindness comes from lack of vitamin A or carotene. So golden rice was engineered to contain carotene so that the sort of epidemic, or I should say endemic blindness occurring in third world countries could be eliminated by using this rice. I think we have a lot of unconscious bias about GMO. There's a certain amount of validity to being concerned, but there's also a blind spot to say all GMO is bad, and therefore there should be no funding or research, or there should be no option for GMO. I think we have to look at it on a case-by-case basis and help get rid of unconscious bias, or at least acknowledge that we have it and take a step back and consider each case on the merits. It's rather a little analogous to racial prejudice or sexism or cisism, I guess would be what we'd call it, or any other kind of one-size-fits-all attitude about a group that's different, or even on individual people who stand out for some reason. We need to open our minds a little bit, I guess, and look at the merits of the case and not believe the first thing we read on the internet, not jump on the bandwagon like the Chinese during the Cultural Revolution, quick to condemn the professor who had taught them because if they didn't condemn them, they might end up in the jail as well. We don't have those kind of penalties here, and I think we should stop acting like scare rabbits and show some courage. So forgive me for meandering content here. Our next topic also relates to something, at least that originated in China, so far as we know, although there are some arguments that it may have been around much earlier than that all over the world. And let's talk about atrial fibrillation and acupuncture. Atrial fibrillation, in case you haven't heard of it, is when the heart beats in a very irregular way, multiple bits of the heart taking over the role of pacemaker. This results in about a 15% loss of efficiency, which many people who are healthy can tolerate, but it does impair their peak athletic performance. It also increases the risk of stroke. The older you get, the higher your risk of stroke anyway. It costs about $26 billion a year in the United States. And what we'd like to do with atrial fibrillation is get people back into sinus rhythm, that is to say, get their pacemaker functioning again and get these sort of revolutionary foci in the left atrium to shut up and behave. There's been a lot of data about acupuncture and whether it can have a beneficial effect in both cardioversion and in maintaining sinus rhythm. My personal experience with acupuncture relates to the fact that a close family member had atrial fibrillation, and several times, just using a few acupuncture needles, we were able to avoid having to go to the emergency room and use paddles and shock the heart. Oh, this is a very simple, straightforward treatment that actually, because of its simplicity, could be taught to family members who, unlike myself, haven't been trained in acupuncture and probably used successfully, particularly since there are now little electrical stimulators that can be placed on the surface of the skin that would probably do that job. In the case study that prompted me to talk to you about this, it was a study using acupuncture to reverse atrial fibrillation in a hospital setting. Basically, a few needles, including one in an area which has the lovely name of Master of the Heart, which I love. This is a channel in acupuncture, an entire channel. The main purpose of is to act as the healthy pacemaker. Stimulation of this channel can eliminate atrial fibrillation, that is to say, act like shocking the heart, but lead to resolution of AFib. And there is also pretty good data that it can work to maintain the person in potential normal rhythm. There have been several studies looking at body points and ear points. And the thing I really love about ear points is that you can leave a little tiny needle in the ear that's about the size of a Barbie thumbtack and cover it with a bit of tape and then simply stimulate it 3 or 4 times a day, more if needed. I use this for pain all the time, but this is the first time I've seen it suggested as an ongoing treatment for atrial fibrillation. So you can bet that I'm going to call up some of my patients and see if they are interested in participating in just a tiny little clinical trial to see what we can do. Okay, I see we've gotten an email. All right, this comes from Barry. Dear Dr. Dawn, please comment on causes of an overactive bladder in females. I am aware of various ways to treat this, but none of them seems wise for a woman who is 76. Are there any items in a person's diet that could be contributing to this issue? Thank you very much. For starters, this is an extremely common problem, and it's a great question to go to because there are some very good acupuncture treatments. Now, the thing about Chinese medicine in general, and acupuncture specifically, is that it works off of disease patterns. The inferred dynamic that's going on is very, very foreign to the Western medical mind. I learned in medical school to talk about something called a cognitive model. Your model is how the world works. If you're an Egyptian in the 10th century BC, the way the world works is that the sun rises because Ra is driving his chariot across the sky. You know, that's what's going on. And the night sky basically swallows the moon and gives birth to it. Well, okay, it's predictive. It's a cognitive model. It may or may not be accurate, but it has predictive value. And so the way I think about a lot of acupuncture and Chinese medicine is that the model is a metaphor. the metaphor works to help you make predictions and make therapeutic decisions. And it's a way of organizing a lot of complex information in a way that you can derive an approach to health or to healing. It doesn't really matter if the problem is wind invasion or a virus, if the treatment, which in Chinese medicine would involve actually bloodletting on the back of your neck, actually alleviates symptoms. And I've had that treatment done for an early cold when I was in training. In fact, it was done in front of an entire classroom of people. And I was definitely coming down with a cold from the flight out to the location. This is back in the days when there's no electronic transmission of data, so you actually have to fly somewhere for a class. And lo and behold, that cold just went away. And it was already in that phase where it felt like it was going to take hold and I was going to be fighting it off for 4 or 5 days. So yes, interesting that that would have an a pro-immune effect and help knock out the cold, or at least knock out the cold symptoms. But it did indeed seem to do that. I've used other treatments on myself. I've reversed blistering on a burn, for example, using Chinese medicine techniques. I have witnesses on that one and photos. So yeah, this is really something. So having meta-commented, let's get back to Elizabeth's question. And Elizabeth, I just want to say that we are looking at a woman in your age group. She will almost certainly have depleted kidney qi and kidney yin. That's just part of the aging process, and it has a very profound effect on the bladder. So tonifying the kidney channel should be helpful in reestablishing normal functioning and getting rid of some of the irritability. There are also herbs that can be used, or combinations of herbs. So you might want to seek out a acupuncture trial and some of these supportive herbs to see whether you get some benefit there. As a functional medicine doctor, one of the major factors in overactive bladder, which is basically frequency, can be problems with your microbiome and also with your hormonal milieu. Recently, I came across a paper, and I've subsequently been using this in patients. I've been quite impressed with its success. And that's using an agent which is ordinarily only used orally, that is to say DHEA, which is something along the lines of dihydro or dihydroxyepiandrosterone. And DHEA is available orally. But in the study that I came across, it was being used vaginally for exactly these sorts of bladder irritability symptoms. And it was showing good results in placebo-controlled, double-blind, checking all the boxes for good science. Subsequently, I went to the methods section in the paper, figured out what dose they were using, and I've been prescribing that to patients because you can get it compounded in a formula, a vaginal cream. And I've been seeing good results. So obviously, this is not one-size-fits-all medicine. You have to look at the individual. You have to rule out comorbidities, like, for example, a bladder infection or a structural abnormality that could be irritating the bladder. But that's where the normal conventional medicine visit comes in. They go and they check the usual suspects and usually don't find anything and give you a anticholinergic drug. I don't like those drugs. They affect cognition. They can cause dizziness and falls. And I had to take my mother off of one. This must be 15 years ago when she was still with us, because she kept falling down. Stopped the drug, she stopped falling down. And of course, that's extraordinarily dangerous when you get into your 80s. So yeah, I don't like the drugs that are conventionally used for this. And I've had some success with the Chinese medicine and the acupuncture and this topical DHEA. A lot of times, Western medicine really doesn't have a good explanation for bladder irritability. I've never heard a good one out of conventional medicine. It's just, oh, well, this is just one of those aging things that you get, and here's a drug to cover it up. That's not my philosophy, and I feel that you might want to check those things Elizabeth and see if they can be helpful for you. Let's hear from Joy in Boulder Creek. Subject matter on her email, leukocytoclastic vasculitis. I was diagnosed with LCV in May of 2010. At that time, it was merely a skin rash. About a year later, I had a round of what I believed to be food poisoning. I never recovered, and the diagnosis for that is IBS, irritable bowel syndrome. Recently, the LCV has escalated. I've been on and off prednisone, but I refuse to take high doses that make me crazy. The current experiment is dapsone. Colchicine had no effect. The IBS is managed by a limited diet, avoiding a few foods that are repeat offenders. I see an acupuncturist every week or so, and I'm approaching 69. Can you see a way out of this diminished life? Yes, Joy, I can, but let's take a moment to talk about this condition of yours. I'm going to compare and contrast the functional medicine viewpoint with the conventional medicine viewpoint. And let's start with the name, leukocytoclastic vasculitis. Okay, so if we break that down, it means that the blood vessels are inflamed and a certain type of white blood cell is breaking down and blowing up and leaving debris. That's kind of what it means. That's a phenomenologic description, similar to the Egyptians' description of Ra's chariot crossing the sky. It's good enough to describe the situation, but it's not very useful when you're talking about what's actually going on. It's merely a syndromic description, as are many of these diseases that we don't understand in conventional medicine. Typically, this disease, just for the audience, is worse below the legs, which is true of most vasculitis. It can be on the butt and the legs, sometimes on localized area in the upper body. And what you see is a red discoloration of the skin. I'll tell you what this actually is. It's a spontaneous hickey. So I'm sure most of you know what a hickey is. And what causes a hickey is suction on the skin. And when the suction is strong enough, the blood vessels leak and red blood cells get out into the surrounding tissue outside of the blood vessels. So then the pigment and the red cells are stuck there until it sort of turns into a bruise and gets carried away by the trash crew, the white blood cells, the macrophages, whose job it is to break this stuff down. In the case of a vasculitis, you get the same sort of hickey, a reddish-purple color, but it's due to the blood vessels being inflamed and that causing the tight junctions in the blood vessels to separate and the red blood cells escape into the dermis. Sometimes you'll even see little blisters, similar to what you see with eczema. Typically, these go away after a while. It's also very similar to the post-inflammatory pigmentation. If you've had an infected wound, you may see a discoloration that stays for a long time. This vasculitis is associated, as you might expect, with autoimmune and connective tissue diseases like lupus. Most of the time, it is benign and self-limited and goes away. In the case of our emailer, it hasn't done so. So what do we know about it? Well, about 50% of the cases just show up. Somewhere around 15 to 20% are caused by staph or strep infections, 15 to 20% by lupus and rheumatoid arthritis, and about 10 to 15% from nonsteroidal and anti-inflammatories and certain antibiotics. And what you really see, if you get your microscope, which is what the people who named it got, is you see that the small blood vessels, small arteries that are carrying blood to the capillaries, and the capillaries and venules, tiny veins themselves, have immune complexes in them. Now, an immune complex is where you have an antibody and an antigen. So, in other words, let's say we have a COVID antibody spike protein antibody that we got because we were vaccinated, and we have a COVID virus, and the antibody jumps on the virus and prevents it from being able to infect our cells. I think we all know that much immunology now after this last 15 months. These proteins are produced by part of the immune system, and once they're deposited in the blood vessels, they attract neutrophils, and the neutrophils, a type of white blood cell, are there to attack bacteria. Once they get to the area and they see these chemical signals, they release their own chemicals, which damage the blood vessel. They're supposed to damage the bacteria, but there's no bacteria, so the blood vessels take the hit. You see on the microscope these white blood cells, neutrophils, surrounding the blood vessels, and inside you see the insides of dead and fragmented neutrophils. So they've done their thing, released their substances, died, and the bits of their dead body are now sitting inside of the blood vessel, hence this cytoclastic piece of the name. Treatment for this starts with very simple things: topical steroids, elevating the legs, compression stockings. Except for the topical steroids, it's the same way we would treat leaky veins, varicose veins, or venous stasis disease. Then we move to colchicine, which didn't work for our writer, dapsone, which is an actual medicine used for leprosy that has some anti-inflammatory properties, and then to the heavy drugs that are immunosuppressants like methotrexate and azathioprine and high-dose steroids. Now let's go to the functional medicine view. Where are the immune complexes coming from? Why are they forming? What antibodies are attacking what thing to create them? That's where we start in functional medicine. So we have some treatments for these sorts of problems, and they're a little bit different than conventional medicine. You'll remember that our emailer had gut problems and has a diagnosis of IBS. So as a functional medicine doctor, I'm like, okay, she probably has gut damage. She's probably leaking all kinds of antigens across her gut barrier, which is no longer doing its job. Instead of having a wall, we've got a chain link fence. Not great for keeping small molecules, rats, mice, things like that, out. Really great for large mammals, but not great for small things. So we want to work on supporting that barrier functioning. Now, they mentioned 50% is unknown. I always say that some of that 50% is going to be food sensitivity, food antigens, chemicals, preservatives, and natural preservatives that are found in plants or proteins that are found in meat. You got to do an elimination diet in this person. You've got to take away the foods they eat a lot of and the foods that more commonly cause this. You've got to look at what they've been eating and make some changes that characterize to that. She said she'd identified a few foods that seem to make it worse. Well, let's find out what she's missing and go after those. A third thing is there is actually a treatment for getting rid of immune complexes, and it's called proteolytic enzymes. These are digestive enzymes. If there's something in the gut to digest, they'll break down protein. But if you take proteolytic enzymes on an empty stomach, particularly if you've got a leaky gut, it's going to go across that leaky gut because it's a chain link fence, not a wall. Those molecules can fit across there, and they're going to wander around the bloodstream where they are harmless except to immune complexes. So what if we break them down while they're still floating around before they have a chance to deposit in the wall of the blood vessels? Well, that's what I'd like to find out. So, Joy, I'm suggesting that you may want to come and see me. I hope that if you have already got a functional medicine doctor who is, let's say, functional medicine literate, these suggestions are fairly straightforward, and anyone who's trained in functional medicine should be able to execute them. So I hope that there is a way out of this diminished life, but it's going to involve a lot of work on your part. All right, so I said some good news about COVID. Well, research just hot off the press is that the vaccines do not pass through breast milk, so that's good, but the antibodies that vaccinated and infected women have do pass through to the baby. And talk a little bit about a woman named Molly Siegel, who is one of the many women we should give a shout out of thanks. She's an obstetrician in Massachusetts, and in last year she was seeing a lot of pregnant people. And she had a 7-month-old baby, so she was worried about breastfeeding. A lot of women were. We know that certain compounds, particularly drugs, can pass through to breast milk. The vaccines, well, she worried about it. She's a scientist. She's a trained woman. She thought, well, she knows that there's no live virus in the vaccine. So she got the shot even before the data came out. And I want to thank all the women who did that. She donated samples of her breast milk, who analyzed the content in one of the first of such studies. Now there have been many studies to the 100 million lactating people across the world. Guess what? Pfizer and Moderna work. They bring up the levels of antibodies quite high after vaccination in both breastfeeding and in lactating and non-lactating women. But those antibodies do get through and they do protect the baby. No vaccine, no mRNA has been detected in that breast milk. We have large enough studies now, two studies, both recruiting over 100 women before and after their vaccine, testing for virus, not finding it, testing for antibodies, and finding it. So the vaccine works on breastfeeding moms. They're not immunosuppressed. When this is important, the antibodies continue to increase. It's just a very, very good thing to be doing if you're breastfeeding, is to get this vaccine. You're protecting your baby as long as you continue to breastfeed. I do want to emphasize that we're going to have to figure out what to do about the babies, because the breast milk contains antibodies, but those antibodies are short-lived in the baby's body, and you have to keep replacing them. Now, in the mom, the antibodies from the breast milk that she has don't actually get into the baby's bloodstream. But what they do is they coat the mouth, the throat, and the gut before they're digested. And during that time, they appear to be providing protection. Obviously, we're not going to deliberately expose infants to COVID, but where it's been looked at, there are fewer cases. Now, we know that those antibodies get through, because we have plenty of data over the years about breastfeeding. Babies who are breastfed for their first 6 months have far fewer middle ear infections, which is great because you don't have to give them antibiotics, which is great because then they establish a healthy microbiome, which is a gift that keeps on giving for the rest of their lives. I had a conversation with a patient just today talking about how if that doesn't happen to you, then you have to kind of baby and, well, let's just say tend your microbiome carefully for the rest of your life in order to keep it healthy. And after a bout of antibiotics, and a person who has a stable, healthy microbiome, they'll replace, and an appendix, I might add, they'll replace their flora fairly quickly. And those that don't, it can be much more difficult. And there's a lot of controversy about this, but it's pretty well known now that the probiotics that you take orally do not permanently establish in your gut. They're as placeholders, kind of like mulch, but they don't do what we would love, which would be to say take root and replace the gut garden. Nevertheless, good news about breastfeeding and COVID. And I mentioned a little bit of bad news. The bad news is that the latest mRNA vaccine turns out to be a dud. This vaccine is called CureVac. It's made by a company based in Tübingen, Germany. Sorry about that to the people grabbing their head and going, ah! But I don't know how to pronounce it correctly. This was a 40,000-person trial, about the size of the preliminary trials that led to the EUA for both Moderna and Pfizer. Unfortunately, the two-dose vaccine was just 47% effective at preventing disease. This is a bummer because this one was going to be cheaper and last longer in refrigerated storage. And it was hoped that this one could be expanded for outreach globally, but it was not to be. So what's the problem with this latest mRNA vaccine? The lipid bubble casing is essentially the same as the Moderna and the Pfizer. But in the early days of vaccine development, the company that makes CureVac decided not to tweak the biochemical makeup of its mRNA. Now, another reason that it may not have worked is because all of these mRNAs were from the first coronavirus, the Alpha, and meanwhile, there have been a whole bunch of other cases, and there's been the genetic drift, and so now we have Delta and Lambda being the largest. In the case of where the study was done, it was done where the Lambda was highest, and I believe that's in Latin America. And it doesn't look like it's going to do well against the Delta, which is the one that's causing the uptick in Europe and in selected states of the United States. Meanwhile, Pfizer's got 92% against these new variants, 83% against the Delta variant, and the Beta variant from South Africa. Both of these vaccines are doing well. Could be the dose, and this is also related to the tweaks in the messenger RNA, so stay with me, it gets a little complicated. The dose range was from 2 to 20 micrograms. But when they gave the high dose, it caused too many side effects, many inflammatory side effects, severe headaches, fatigue, chills, and injection site pain. So the best tolerated dose was 12 micrograms, but that was too low to get good levels of neutralizing antibody. The reason for this probably has to do with the fact that the mRNA that was used by Moderna and Pfizer was actually fundamentally different because they changed one of the nucleotides in there in the mRNA from uridine to pseudouridine. Uridine is part of the genetic code. What they did with the CureVac is they just changed the last letter and hoped it would work, but it didn't. We've long known with mRNA vaccines, it's one of the reasons it took them so long to be developed, that modified mRNA is less inflammatory. So the immune system recognizes the virus more easily if you have uridine in there. When they put the pseudouridine in there, it changed it enough that the immune system didn't twig to the fact that this was a foreign messenger RNA. So it was kind of a piece of camouflage. So is it the camouflage that the lack thereof that led to a stronger immune reaction, which led to poor tolerance of a high enough dose to get the kind of immune response we need? Well, that's my vote in terms of this complex issue. But it just goes to show that it wasn't a home run. It was good science and good decision-making that led to the rapid success of the Pfizer and the Moderna vaccines that was so phenomenal. It was a spot of good luck and a spot of good science bringing us where we need to be. Okay, so we have a caller on line one. Hello, you're on the air.
Hi, yes. My name's Chris, and hello to you. So here's my question. I didn't catch the first part of your show, but I caught the part where you started just talking about the vaccines and their effectiveness, et cetera. And I'm just wondering if, in a general way, you could speak to the issue, the real problem with regards to uptake, say, just in the United States, right, the anti-vaxxers or the vaccine hesitants, as some of them are called. But, like, you know, Biden, I guess he's not going to hit that goal that he wanted by July 4th, apparently. And here's my question, actually. I have a sister who's an RN, registered nurse, who's over 60, whose husband has comorbidities. She caught COVID in November and weathered it, didn't have too many any real complications, and so she was out of the hospital for a little while. So in any event, when I mentioned I was going to get the vaccine, you know, I discovered, lo and behold, that she's an anti-vaxxer. She, or at least again, she's like, what, you're not getting that, are you? I go, yes, of course I am. Why wouldn't I, you know? Well, how do you know what's in it? So, you know, went down that route, and I went ahead and got it, and, you know, and she told me just the other day, I got, you know, the full vaccine, and she was, you know, I can't believe you did it. And she goes, you should read Dr. Lee, blah, 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 you know, which I looked her up. And this doctor is an orthopedist who is like an anti-masker and an anti-vaxxer. Right? So it's like, And I even said, you're looking at the fringe. So how do we battle the fact that an RN who told me she would quit her job if her hospital mandates vaccines for the employees, she said, I will quit. That's what she told me twice, two different times. So how do we combat this? Because I'm very frustrated. It's like my own sister I'm close to, we're like splitting on this, you know?
Yeah, I hear you, Chris. Well, let's start off with serenity prayer. You know that one? Accept the things you cannot change, change the things you can, and the wisdom to know the difference.
Yeah, okay. Exactly.
Right. Okay. Well, changing another person's mind, in my view, falls into category one, which is, you know, you're not going to change the person's mind. Only the person can do that. So yeah. The first thing you want to do is identify, you know, what are the concerns? What are the actual concerns. You're not going to try to disprove it. You know, that doesn't seem to work, especially, like you say, if people are reading these sort of weaponized sites. Sometimes, you know, I think, and I've used this a couple of times with success, is I've used in the right person, you use the follow the money. The follow the money is So what's this person's website doing? Are they making money from it? Because most of us, especially if you're an orthopedist, you've got a good job. You know, you can make plenty of money as an orthopedist. Are you spending all this time running a website because there's money coming in from speakers' fees or from ads on the website or you know, things like that? So I always think a follow the money approach. Just to, you're not going to change her, but you might get her thinking, let's check out this person's cred, and if she's a critical thinker, you know, that could help. But that's why you've got to pick your target. Another thing that is, I think, very helpful is to ask open-ended questions. Just what is it about this that you're afraid of? And also, what level of evidence? Is there anything that would allow you to change your mind? And just open-ended question, not, is it possible you would change your mind? And if there's certain things that came out later that, you know, what would it take to change your mind? What are your concerns? And sometimes it's really ideological issue. You know, it's like, I'm free to go to hell in my own way, so to speak. You know, that's not to say that she's going to go to hell. Please don't think I'm saying that. But just, it was a phrase my mom used all the time. You know, don't fight it. They're a free agent. We live in the land of the free and the home of the brave. And sometimes people are a little too brave, but that's their business. Now, there is a social responsibility issue. And you said her husband has comorbidities, so let me ask you, has he protected himself, or is he still at risk?
No, I'm sure not. I didn't ask her that. I didn't go that far. They live in Louisiana, so I don't get a chance to really see them often, I guess.
All right. Well, I think that what will often make a difference, and I observed this myself in Watsonville, where I live in North Monterey County. I shop in Watsonville. And over the spring of 2020... we had a huge spike of cases in South County, in South Santa Cruz County.
Right, yeah.
And what I watched was, I watched, and I'm going to say Latino, and I don't care who calls me on it, I'm going to say Latino. I saw the Latino community initially kind of blow off the mask thing, and then long around August, it's like they all got the memo, and that's because we had a huge surge, and by then everybody knew somebody who had gotten very sick. And the conversation with my neighbor across the street, which, you know, initially he was kind of skeptical and, you know, he sort of thought this was just a little bit of paranoia. You know, then after his cousin went to his father's funeral and then got COVID and ended up hospitalized at 28.
Wow.
He started going, okay, yeah. So it's a little bit like the thing with prejudice. I mentioned prejudice earlier in the show. You probably missed that part. But if you grow up in a mixed ethnic neighborhood and there are, you know, Latinos and Asians and African Americans and white people and Hmong and, you know, the whole thing, you know nice people who are fill in the blank, and you know, and the guy who helped you out when you needed it is fill in the blank, and he's not your race. And you know what? People, nice people and mean people come in all races. And so you kind of don't have this stereotypical idea because you have personal experience, which is contrary. Nothing beats personal experience. Ultimately, I hope that the personal experience that your sister gets isn't having her husband or herself get deathly ill or, God forbid, even pass due to the resurgence this winter.
As I mentioned, she had COVID in November, right? Last November, before the vaccines came out. And that's when I said, gee, I heard you might have to get a booster. That's how this whole thing came up. And she said, well, I'm not getting that. And I went, well, are you getting your vaccine? I said, yeah. And I'm just amazed that someone would actually throw away their wonderful career as an RN for 25 years, you know, based on, you know, whatever she's basing it on. I don't know. It's very interesting.
Yeah, but I mean, think about, I saw a film the other day, and it was about women spies in World War II. I forget the name, or I would tell you, because it was quite good. But anyway, there was this real serious propaganda campaign that I really didn't know about. I kind of sort of knew about it, but the film really underlined how much bad information about, you know, how terrible Jews were was given to the French people. Everything that was going on was blamed on Jews and their, you know, their attempt to take over the world economy. And so these people had bad information that led them to make bad decisions. People will accept bad information from authoritative sources, you know, referencing the Cultural Revolution that I also talked about, and they'll make poor decisions that ultimately they're shooting themselves in the foot or worse. But you can't fix that. What I would suggest is talk to your brother-in-law. If he hasn't been vaccinated, then one of the ways that he can be protected is just to, if she's anti-mask, maybe she's not anti-swab. You can swab the nose of people coming into the house and make sure that if you have a caregiver or a cleaner or someone and they aren't willing to wear a mask, make them swab their nose. It's going to cost $20, and it's like a pregnancy test. So prove you're not shedding virus. As far as she's concerned, she could get a subclinical case and kill her husband. So that might be your wedge issue, but you're going to need to go find some cases. You know, go find some instances, go find some articles and say, look, I'm not worried about you. You've had it. You're a strong woman. But I'm worried about Ralph. I'm worried that that you might accidentally, not meaning to, bring it home, and he may not be as strong as you. He may not be able to fight it off as well as you can. That might be your only wedge approach, and I'm not sure that would work. But you have to come from a position of caring and respect. The minute you start to argue, you've lost.
Exactly. Yeah, thank you. That's actually true. And I would, on your point about masks, and her, she's a nurse. She has no issue with masks. That's, you know, she does, you know, do some of that, right? Some of the things you should do. But it's interesting to me that the disinformation, I mean, I mentioned, I'll say this, I know you have to go in a moment, but I said that, and you're right, I got an argument, which is not good, you're right. But I said, I'm looking at trusted sources, you know, NIH, you know, New England Journal of Medicine, Lancet, you know, this is what I'm looking at. Oh, I'm looking at trusted sources too. And then she gave me that name, you know, this person who I looked up later and saw, I saw her, she's a total kook. I mean, absolutely, but, you know, MDs can be kooks too, I guess, you know, but that's the site, like you said, she's going to and getting absolutely the false
right information. But you have to take a step back. First of all, there's a saying in medicine, in a code blue, take your own pulse, and I can hear in your voice how agitated you're getting, and you need to release that. That's why I started out saying serenity prayer. Your only hope for success is to speak from a position of caring and be absolutely non-oppositional, open-minded questions, open-ended questions, seriously doing what you did, and, you know, not saying she's a kook about the doctor, but saying, you know, I listened to what she had to say, and there were things about her argument I didn't find persuasive, or I found her argument unconvincing. But more about that, I'm primarily worried about Ralph, and I'm wondering what we can do to protect him, and kind of, I would say, start there, approach it as a problem-solving exercise, and maybe you can get her engaged and at least eliminate that worst-case scenario.
I appreciate that, and thank you. No, and if you knew my family, you'd understand the emotional intensity.
it's not going to fly here. So you want to be successful. You got to find a new tactic. Good, thanks, Chris. Right. Appreciate your call. I think it was very useful for a lot of people.
Yeah. Okay. Thank you very much.
Bye bye. Newsflash. There was a coronavirus epidemic 20,000 years ago, according to a new study. The way they figured this out is just brilliant. But as we know, coronaviruses can cross the species barrier and create epidemics. And so some researchers who were really kind of looking at patterns of genetic variation to reconstruct a history of viruses started looking at coronaviruses recently. I wonder why. And what they found is in East Asian populations, this would be Indonesia, areas like that, Malaysia, they found 42% of people had a dominant version of a certain gene. The dominant gene passes to both children. One copy is good enough, and it's usually a structural gene. So what this gene was A, it's limited to East Asia. Because genes randomly mutate over time, and the more time passes, the more the mutations accumulate, if a gene is lethal or it causes a poor reproductive success, it evaporates over a couple of hundred years. But if the gene has a benefit, then it can spread throughout a population. They found that there were 42 genes that all were dominant genes. They all conferred resistance to coronavirus, and they all had the same number of mutations, which means they happened about 20 to 25,000 years ago, spread across East Asia. Now, this is back when you're talking hunter-gatherers. There are no boats. This mutation, this particular coronavirus never spread, and the mutation never spread. But genetic archaeology, wow, what an interesting idea. Well, that's about all for this week's podcast. Please go to AskDrDawn.com for news about our future plans, or follow my tweets at AskDrDawn. For now, this is Dr. Dawn saying so long and stay healthy.
Ask Dr. Dawn is brought to you by Jiva Media. Production and editing by Charles Mansky. Music by John Scoville.